Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Let's begin. So we're on page 18 of this book. Okay, from the above definitions of some of the major key concepts in Islam, which all converge upon the concept of knowledge. So knowledge is very, very important in Islam, as anybody who studies or is a practicing Muslim would know. It becomes clear that their meanings are closely interrelated. So all of these meanings that we've discussed in the last lesson are interrelated. In particular, their meanings, which all focus upon the notion of proper place. So we talked about adab in the last lesson, that in Islam, in Islamic cosmos or cosmology, everything in creation has its place, right? So whether we're talking about gender, whether we're talking about relationships, whether we're talking about items, whatever we're talking about, everything has its place. And anyone that reads the Quran and the Sunnah will get this idea that Prophet ﷺ has placed for us things in their proper place, right? Which points to a certain order, and that's very, very important. When things are misplaced or not placed in their proper place, philosophically speaking, then you have chaos, right? Because that's the zid, that's the opposite. So the proper place, which points to a certain order in the system and one's relation to that order. The order is in the form of hierarchy, which pervades the created order of being and existence. So we do have a concept in Islam of hierarchy, right? There are relationships. Some people are above others based on certain things, okay, or divinely ordained. Both external existence and mental existence, right? So there is a form of hierarchy which pervades the created order of being and existence, both external existence and mental existence. What do you mean by hierarchy? Because hierarchy, when we think of hierarchy in our context, in the modern discourse, we often think of like the person who's above or something that's above is better than what's below, right? That's how often we think of it. But that's not entirely true. So the hierarchy, I mean, when applied to the human order, is not to be understood as the kind of hierarchy created by man and articulated into a social structure, right? Such as caste, such as a system of caste or a graded priestly organization or any kind of social stratification according to class. So we're not talking about, you know, middle class, upper class, working class, etc. It is not something to be organized into a social structure. It's rather something to be organized in the mind and actualized in the attitude and behavior. So what is the organization in the mind? The organization in the mind is not formulated by human criteria of power, wealth, and lineage. Right? These are not the criteria we are looking at in terms of how the hierarchy works in the mind, but by the Quranic criteria of knowledge, intelligence, and virtue. Right? These are the virtue character traits. These are virtuous things. When the mind recognizes the reality that knowledge and being are ordered according to their various levels and degrees, and when the attitude and the behavior acknowledges by action what the mind recognizes, then this conformity of the acknowledgement with a recognition by which the self assumes its proper place in coincidence with the act of acknowledgement is none other than other. So once you understand this in the mind, this Quranic idea, criteria of knowledge, intelligence, virtue, you understand how it works. You have it mentally placed in the right place, and then you acknowledge it. You practice it accordingly. This is other, right? So it's not just an intellectual thing about knowing the hierarchy, right? But it's also practice. You actualize it, you recognize it, and then you actualize it. So, but when the mind displaces the levels and degrees of knowledge and being, disrupting the order in a legitimate hierarchy, then this is due to the corruption of knowledge, right? Because our epistemology, our truth, the way we understand truth is muddled, right? Whereas we believe that we have an order. Allah has given us a system. Such corruption is reflected in the confusion of justice, so that the notion of proper places no longer applies in the mind or externally, and the disintegration of adab take place. So, you know, he gives the example of justice here, right? If justice is not understood correctly in the mind, then you're going to actualize it incorrectly. So So what is the Quranic view of justice? What does justice mean when it comes to the Quran, right? And if you don't intellectualize it properly, if it's not understood properly in the mind, in its right place, then you're going to have chaos. It's not, you're not gonna, you know, you're gonna have, as he says, the disintegration of adab takes place. So justice is going to be misplaced. So when you see, in other words, when you see problems in society, right, and things not being done in its, in the way it should be done, then that comes back to knowledge, i.e. it's not been understood properly. So the disintegration of adab, which is the effect of the corruption of knowledge, can you see its effect of it, creates a situation whereby false leaders in all spheres of life emerge, right? For it not only implies the corruption of knowledge, but also means the loss of the capacity and ability to recognize and acknowledge true leaders. So you have wrong people who become leaders, people who are not suited for those positions of leadership, right? Because of the intellectual anarchy that characterizes this situation, the common people become determiners of intellectual decisions and are raised to a level of authority on matters of knowledge, right? Because of this confusion and corruption of knowledge, the wrong people come into places of leadership, and that just creates, they just make the wrong decisions, right? Because they aren't endowed with wisdom. They aren't endowed with knowledge, the virtue that we've talked about before, right? Intelligence and so forth. Authentic definitions become undone, and in their stead, we are left with platitudes and vague slogans disguised as profound concepts, right? So, you know, you hear people making really, really deep, what seem to be profound statements, but really there's nothing behind it, right? You see it today, you know, even in public discourse, politicians and other people who make really, really bold statements, but they're as corrupt as, you know, you can get. The inability to define, to identify and isolate problems, and hence to provide for right solutions, the creation of pseudo problems, the reduction of problems to mere political, social, economic, and legal factors become evident, right? Because we haven't defined things properly, we don't know how to isolate problems. What we basically do in our societies, we just create patchwork systems. We just create more laws. You might have been hearing about lately in the news about, you know, women being abused or not feeling safe in public spaces, right? And that's a problem. That's a societal problem. But we need to diagnose, we need to understand what is the real problem here, right? Do we just need to have more laws? How are we going to deal with this, right? And so we in Islam, we have a system for dealing with that. We have intellectual discourse for dealing with that. But if you don't apply it properly, if you don't identify the problem properly, then you're just gonna have more and more problems, right? It is not surprising if such a situation provides a fertile breeding ground for the emergence of deviationists and extremists of many kinds who make ignorance their capital. Right? So you have people who you just have a society of chaos because there's no order. People haven't placed knowledge in its right place. So something to bear in mind when it comes to this discussion as well. Right, I'm just going to talk about this paragraph here. Language reflects ontology, right? How being, right? Introducing key concepts foreign to a language involves not merely the translating of words. So when we, many of you who are studying in academia will need to think about this, right? The way you use language reflects how you see things, how you understand things, your relationship with that thing, right? So introducing key concepts foreign to a language involves not merely translating a word. It's not enough just to translate it, right? But more profoundly, the translating of symbolic forms belonging to the super system of a foreign worldview, not compatible with the worldview projected by the language into which some concepts are introduced. So you have to do some work, okay? So it's not just about translating, but it's a translating of symbolic forms belonging to the super system of a foreign worldview, not compatible with the worldview projected by language in which some such concepts. So if you're bringing something into the Anglophone world, right, from South Asia or from the Muslim world, you have to think really hard about just using that word. So for example, I'm writing a chapter on tradition. Now, tradition is not used by Muslims, at least until recently. So when you say traditional Muslims, right, these are traditional Muslims. Now, of course, Muslims use this word, so it's entered our vocabulary, right? It's entered our discourse. But what does it mean, right, to us? And how do we then translate that? How do we then conceptualize that? How do we bring in the meanings and forms of tradition to be able to explain it to a group of people or to a worldview to whom that worldview is different or that word is understood differently, right? So those responsible for introducing them and advocating their currency are the scholars, academics, journalists, critics, politicians, and amateurs not firmly grounded upon knowledge of the essentials of religion and its vision of reality and truth. One of the main causes for the emergence of intellectual confusion and anarchy is the changes and restrictions which they have effected in the meanings of key terms that project the worldview of Islam, which is derived from revelation. So a lot of people, they translate these words from Islamic, or they bring them into the Islamic worldview, but they haven't done the long work, hard work of trying to, talk about the symbolic meanings of these words. What do they actually mean, right? And so there's confusion, there's anarchy, right? When we say the imam is like a priest, right? We have to do some work to explain what that means. Is he like the priest? Is it the same thing? What is an imam, right? And you've seen recently about how, a sister was asked questions about why there aren't female imams, right? So this is important when it comes to language, right? Because the confusion comes from the fact that we've just translated the word across, but we haven't really done the work of trying to bring out what that word actually is or means. What does an imam mean? What does a priest mean? Where are the points of overlap? Where are the points of convergence? Where are the points of divergence, right? The major factor that influenced their thinking is undoubtedly the introduction of the concept of secular and its implications into our language and our universe of discourse, which Muslims as a whole have yet to perceive from its perspective. So we're still dealing with the secular hegemony, right? And how do we create our own worldview? How do we maintain our own worldview? How do we work with secularism and its discourse, right? So the concepts of secular and its implications into our language and our universe of discourse, right? We haven't been able to do that, right? So this is something to bear in mind as well. Now he goes into a little bit of history, and I'm just going to introduce this and we can continue next week. Now, the secular worldview is obviously a uniquely Christian European inheritance. So the early Latinized Western Christian church monopolized learning and coined the term seculum, to refer to people who are unable to read and write. That's how it was understood. Who are therefore not learned in the arts and sciences, especially in law and medicine, who are then generally called the laity. In Islam, again, I'm using translation, right? In Islam, we would say awam, but maybe that's not the same, right? But anyway, who are generally called the laity, the non-professional, not expert, right? So these are the people who are the not so educated people in society. Due to the preoccupation of such people in mundane matters, the term also conveys a general meaning of being concerned with the affairs of the world, right? They are dunyavi, if you like, the affairs of the world, of not being not sacred, not monastic, not ecclesiastical, of being something temporal, something profane, right? So they're people of this world, if you like, because they are concerned with the mundane affairs. Hence, we find this term being translated by Christian Arabs into Christian Arabic is as this word here that we have. I don't know what this word is. Al-Mani. Anyway, Al-Mani meaning laysa min arbab al-fan wal-hirfa. Right? Then they're people who are not from. They're not scholarly people. And secularity as al-ihtimam bi-umum al-dunya. Al-ihtimam bi-umur al-dunya. They are concerned with dunyawi, worldly engagements, right? Or al-ihtimam bil-alamiyat. They are interested they are engrossed with alam, with this world. And to secularize as how al-gharth al-alami dunyavi, right? So the translation of term is in various grammatical forms, in a sense understood by Western Christian Church and Christian Arab translators, has been allowed to gain currency in contemporary mainstream Islamic Arabic, despite the clear fact that it has no relevance to Islam and to the Muslim Ummah. Right? This conceptualization has no relevance, he argues, with our worldview as Muslims. There is no equivalent to the concept of secular. We don't have the concept of secular, especially when there is no equivalent to church or clergy. We don't have a church or clergy. And when Islam does not concede that there is a dichotomy of the sacred and profane, right? We don't believe in this. We don't separate this, the sacred and the profane. And then what results in that is, he says, that because of this dichotomy, the demeaning of the profane world, i.e. this world, is no longer given the respect that it should have. In the Quran, we are clearly told, for example, that we have a duty to look after this world, right? We have been given khalif, right? Khilafah. So we don't have this concept of separating the sacred domain, sacred and profane, because once you start doing that, and you see it now, that the people who subscribe to the secular outlook, the world is just there for pillaging, right? You can just treat it how you want. If, he says, the nearest equivalent were to be found in Islam to the concept secular, then it would be that which is connoted by the Quranic concept of al-hayat al-dunya. So he says, let's use something that's in the Quran. And he says, the worldly life. The word dunya, derived from dana, conveys the meaning of something being brought near, i.e. dana means something that's close to us. So that's something to bear in mind. This something that is being brought near, according to my interpretation, is the world together with all its parts, for it is the world that is being brought near, that is being brought near to the experience and conscience of man, i.e. what we see right now, what we experience right now. Hence the world is called a dunya. This is what we are experiencing right now. But the akhirah is also another world that's going to come after this immediate world. By virtue of the fact that what is being brought near, that is the world and the life in it, surround us as it were and overwhelm us, they are bound to distract from consciousness of our final destination. This is the nature of the dunya, because it's immediate, right? Which is beyond this world and this life, as they are bound to distract us from consciousness of our final destination, which is beyond this world and this life, which is what comes after. That is the akhirah, right? Since it comes at the end, and al-akhirah is felt as far, and this accentuates the destruction created by what is near. So most people are engrossed in what is the immediate, right? But they're not looking at, they've been distracted by the immediate towards what is to come later on, right? And the Quran, of course, tells us that the hereafter is better, خَيْرٌ وَأَبْقَى, is better than the life of this world. It's more abiding and is everlasting, right? However, this is really important. The Quran, in no terms, does not derogate the world itself or dissuade from contemplation, reflection, interpretation of it and its wonders, right? So the world, when we look at the world, we use it as a way to think about the divine, to connect to the divine, right? To reflect upon God and his creation and the life to come as well. Rather, it extols the world of creation, urges us to contemplate and reflect upon it and its wonders in order that we might be able to interpret and derive their practical and beneficial purpose. The Holy Quran warns of the distracting and ephemeral nature of life in this world. So it is a distraction. The warning emphasis in the concept of al-hayat al-dunya is the life in it, not the world, right? So it's not the world itself, lizatihi, it's not the world itself, but the life in it, right? So that's what the Quran warns us about. So the world and nature are not demeaned as implied in the concept secular. So we don't demean the world or nature as it might be done in the concept of the secular outlook, if you like, right? That is why I said that the hayat dunya is the nearest equivalent to the concept circular. It's not exactly the same, because in actual fact, there is no real equivalent concept in the worldview of Islam projected by the Holy Quran. Okay, so there isn't really, we don't really have a secular religious binary as we have in the West. Moreover, since the world is that which is brought near, and since the world and nature are signs of or ayat of God, it is the signs of God that are brought near to our experience and consciousness. And it would be blasphemous, to say the least, to derogate the world and nature, knowing them in their true character and purpose. So we don't derogate the world. We don't think of it that way. It's used, we think about the world as a means of reflecting upon the divine. It is God's manifestation of his infinite mercy and loving kindness that he caused his signs to be brought near to us, the better for us to understand their intended meanings. There can be no excuse, therefore, for those who struck by awe of the signs, worship them instead of God to him whom they point. And those who seeking God yet demean, abjure his signs because they see tempting evil in them and not in themselves. Or again, those who denying God appropriate his signs for their own materialistic ends and change them in pursuit of illusory development, right? We are meant to look at the world and use it as a means to reflect upon the divine, to bring us closer to Allah, to God. But what people do is they forget about the purpose, and they take the world as their God. They make the world as their entire existence, right? The world cannot develop as it is already perfect according to its own fitrah. Only life in the world can develop, right? Allah has given us this perfect world. There is a final end to the world, just as there is a final end to life in the world. Development of life in the world is that which leads to success in that which comes after it. Absolutely central. For us, development, for us, liberalism, or for us, progress is not, making more machines or more technology. This isn't it. For us, it's about making the world a better place to live. But ultimately, it's about success in the life to come, right? That's the ultimate success. For there is no development unless it is aligned to a final objective, right? There's no development until it's aligned to a final objective. For us, it's to seek the pleasure of God and to seek salvation, to get into Jannah and to protect and save ourselves from his wrath, right? That's for us, progress. Anything that brings us closer to that is progress. Progress is not purely in materialistic terms, right? We don't measure, progress by how many times we go to space or what technology we invent and so forth, right? It's about happiness. It's about seeking salvation. It's about the ultimate purpose, the final objective. We'll stop there, inshallah, and we'll continue next week. Subhanallah bihamdihi, subhanakallahumma bihamdika, nashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk.